After a great deal of to-ing and fro-ing, Teal turned to him. "They don't claim to know anything about a syrinx. Then again, I don't think these men necessarily would know. But one of them, Locrian, is going back to the other ship. I think he needs to signal some higher up or something." "It's what I was expecting," Merlin said. "Tell him I'll wait, and tell the other one he's welcome to drink with us." Teal relayed this message, then said, "He'll stay, but he doesn't need anything to drink. His loss." While Locrian went back through the airlock, Baylis joined them in the lounge, looking incongruous in his heavily armoured suit. Teal tried to engage him in conversation, but he had obviously been ordered to keep his communications to a strict minimum. Merlin helped himself to some wine, before catching his own pink-eyed reflection and deciding enough was enough, for now. "What do you think's going on?" Teal asked, when an hour had passed with no word from the other ship.
"Stuff.
Aren't you concerned?"
"Terribly."
"You don't look or sound it. You want this syrinx, don't you?"
"Very much so."
Baylis looked on silently as his hosts spoke in Maine. If he understood any part of it, there was no clue on his face. "But you seem so nonchalant about it all," Teal said. Merlin pondered this for a few seconds. "Do you think being not nonchalant would make any difference?"
"I don't know that it would. We're here in the moment, aren't we? And the moment will have its way with us, no matter how we feel about things."
"Fatalist."
"Cheerful realist. There's a distinction."
Merlin raised his empty, wine-stained glass.
"Isn't there, Baylis? You agree, don't you, my fine fellow?"
Baylis parted his lips and gave a grunt.
"They're coming back," Teal said,
catching movement through the nearest window. "A shuttle of some sort. Not just people in suits. Is that good or bad?"
"We'll find out."
Merlin bristled a hand across his chin. "Mind me while I go and shave my beard."
"Shave your tongue while you're at it."
Merlin had just finished freshening up when the lock completed its cycle, and the two suited individuals came aboard. One of them, wearing a green and gold suit, turned out to be Locrian. He took off his helmet and motioned for the other, wearing a red and gold suit, to do likewise. This suit was less ostentatiously armoured than the other, designed for a smaller frame. But when the figure lifted their helmet off, glanced at Locrian and uttered a few terse words, Merlin had no difficulty picking up on the power relationship between the two. The newcomer was an old man, old at least in Merlin's reckoning, 70 or 80 years, by the cohort way of accounting such things. He had fine aristocratic features, accented by a high imperious brow and a back-combed sweep of pure white hair. His eyes were a liquid grey, like little wells of mercury, suggesting a sharp, relentless intelligence. Officer class, Merlin thought. The man spoke to them. His voice was soft, undemonstrative. Merlin still did not understand a word of it, but just the manner of speaking conveyed an assumption of implicit authority.
"His name is Baskin," Teal said, when the man had left a silence for her to speak.
"Prince Baskin. Havergal royalty. That's his own personal cruiser out there. He was on some sort of patrol when they picked up our presence. They came at full thrust to meet us. Baskin says things come out of the way now and then, and it's always a scramble to get to them before the enemy.
If Locrian's spoken to him, then he already knows our names. Ask him about the syrinx." Teal passed on Merlin's question. Baskin answered. Teal ruminated on his words, then said, "He says that he's very interested to learn of your interest in the Syrinx. I bet he is. He also says that he'd like to continue the conversation on his cruiser. He says that we'll be guests, not prisoners, and that we'll be free to return here whenever we like. Tell Prince Baskin, yes, we'll join him, but if I'm not back on Tyrant in 12 hours, my ship will take action to retrieve me. If you can make that sound like a polite statement of fact, rather than a crudely worded threat, that would be lovely." "He says there'll be no difficulty," Teal said. "He's right about that," Merlin answered. Part of Prince Baskin's cruiser had been spun to simulate gravity. There was a stateroom, as grand as anything Merlin had encountered, all shades of veneered wood and polished metal, with red drapes and red fabric on the chairs. The floor curved up gently from one end of the room to the other, and this curvature was echoed in the grand table that took up much of the space. Prince Baskin was at one end of it, Merlin and Teal at the other, with the angle of the floor making Baskin seem to tilt forward like a playing card, having to lift his head to face his guests. Orderlies had fussed around them for some time, setting plates and glasses and cutlery, before bringing in the elements of a simple but well-prepared meal. Then, rather to Merlin's surprise, they had left the three of them alone, with only stony-faced portraits of royal ancestors and nobility for company. Men on horses, men in armour, men with projectile guns and energy weapons, both grand and foolish in their pomp. "This is pure ostentation," he said, looking around the room with its sweeping curves and odd angles. "No one in their right mind puts centrifugal gravity on a ship this small. It takes up too much room, costs too much in mass, and the spin differential between your feet and heads enough to make you dizzy." "If the surroundings are not quite to your taste, Merlin, we could adjourn to one of the Renouncer's weightless areas." Prince Baskin had spoken. Teal cocked her chin to face him. The curvature of the room made it like talking to someone halfway up a hill. "You speak, Main. Atrey. Then why?" she began. Baskin smiled and tore a chunk off some bread, dipping it into soup before proceeding. "Please join me, and please forgive my slight deception in pretending to need to have your words translated, as well as my rustiness with your tongue. What I have learned, I have done so from books and recordings, and until now, I have never had the opportunity to speak it to a living soul." He bit into the bread and made an eager motioning gesture that they should do likewise. "Please, eat. My cook is excellent, as well he should be, given what it costs me to ship him and his kitchen around. Teal, I must apologise, but there was no deception where Locrian and Baylis were concerned. They genuinely did not speak Maine and were in need of your translation. I am very much the exception." "How?" Merlin started. "I was a sickly child, I suppose you might say. I had many hours to myself, and in those hours, as one does, I sought my own entertainment. I used to play at war, but toy soldiers and tabletop campaigns will only take you so far. So I developed a fascination with languages. Many centuries ago, a cohort ship stopped in our system. They were here for 2 years, two of your years, I should say, long enough for trade and communication. Our diplomats tried to learn Maine, and by the same token, The cohort sent in negotiating teams who did their best to master our language. Of course, there were linguistic ties between the two, so the task was not insurmountable, but difficult all the same. I doubt that either party excelled itself, but we did what was needed, and there was sufficient mutual understanding. Baskin turned his head to glance at the portraits to his right, each painting set at a slight angle to its neighbours. It was a very long time ago, as I'm sure you appreciate. When the cohort had gone, there was great emphasis placed on maintaining our grasp of their language, so that we'd have a head start the next time we needed it. Schools, academies, and so on. King Curtle was instrumental in that. He was nodding at one of the figures in the portraits, a man of similar age and bearing to himself, and dressed in state finery, not too far removed from the formal wear in which Baskin now appeared. But that soon died away. The cohort never returned, and, as the centuries passed, there was less and less enthusiasm for learning Maine. The schools closed, and by the time it came down to me, 40 generations later, all that remained were the books and recordings. There was no living speaker of Maine. So I set myself the challenge to become one, and encouraged my senior staff to do likewise. And here I am now, sitting before you, and doubtless making a grotesque mockery of your tongue. Merlin broke bread, dipped it into the soup, made a show of chewing on it before answering. "This cohort ship that dropped by," he said, his mouth still full. "Was it the Shrike?" Teal held her composure, but he caught the sidelong twitch of her eye. "Yes," Baskin said, grimacing slightly. "You've heard of it?" "It's how I know about the Syrinx," Merlin said, trying to sound effortlessly matter-of-fact. "I found the Shrike. It was a wreck, all her crew dead. Been dead for centuries, in fact. But the computer records were still intact." He lifted a goblet and drank. The local equivalent to wine was amber-coloured and had a lingering woody finish. Not exactly to his taste, but he'd had worse. "That's why I'm here."
"And Teal?"
"I travel with Merlin," she said. "He isn't good with languages, and he pays me to be his translator."
"You showed a surprising faculty with our own," Baskin said. "Records of your language were in the files Merlin pulled from the wreck. It wasn't that hard to pick up the rudiments."
Baskin dabbed at his chin with napkin. "You picked up more than the rudiments, if I might say."
Merlin leaned forward. "Is it true about the Syrinx?"
"Yes," Baskin said. "We keep it in a safe place on Havergal, intact, insofar as we can tell. Would that be of interest to you?"
"I think it might."
"But you must already have one, if you've come here by the way."
Teal said, "His Syrinx is broken, or at least damaged. He knows it won't last long, so he needs to find a spare."
Again Baskin turned to survey the line of portraits.
"These ancestors of mine knew very little but war. It dominated their lives utterly. Even when there was peace, they were thinking ahead to the moment that peace would fail, and how they might be in the most advantageous position when that day came, as it always did. My own life has also been shaped by the war. Disfigured, you might say. But I have lived under its shadow long enough. I should very much like to be the last of my line who ruled during wartime."
"Then end the war," Merlin said.
"I should like to, but it must be under our terms. Gafurius is stretched to its limits. One last push, one last offensive, and we can enforce a lasting peace. But there is a difficulty." Which is? Teal asked. Something of ours has fallen into the wrong hands. An object we call the Iron Tactician.
Baskin continued eating for several moments, in no rush to explain himself.
I don't know what you've learned of our history, but for centuries, both sides in this war have relied on artificial intelligences to guide their military planning.
I suppose this is another of those machines, Merlin said.
Yes and no. For a long time, our machines were well matched with those of the enemy. We would build a better one, then they would. We would respond, and so on. A gradual escalating improvement. So it went on. Then, by some happy stroke, our cyberneticists created a machine that was generations in advance of anything they had. For 50 years, the Iron Tactician has given us an edge, a superiority. Its forecasts are seldom in error. The enemy still has nothing to match it, which is why we have made the gains that we have. But now, on the eve of triumph, we have lost the Iron Tactician.
Careless, Merlin said. A tightness pinched the corner of Baskin's mouth.
The Tactician has always needed to be close to the theatre of battle so that its input data is as accurate and up-to-date as possible. That was why our technicians made it portable, self-contained and self-reliant. Of course, there are risks in having an asset of that nature.
What happened? Teal asked. Did Gafurius capture it?
Thankfully, no, Baskin answered. But it's very nearly as bad. The Tactician has fallen into the hands of an unaligned third party. Brigands, mercenaries, call them what you will. Now they wish to extract a ransom for the Tactician's safe return, or they will sell it on to the enemy. We know their location, an asteroid holdout, and if we massed a group of ships, we could probably overwhelm their defences. But if Gafurius guessed our intentions and moved first...
Baskin lifted his glass, peering through it at Merlin and Teal, so that his face swam distorted, one mercurial eye wobbling to immensity, while the other shrunk to a tight, cold glint.
So there you have it, a simple proposition. The Syrinx is yours, Merlin, provided you recover the Tactician for us.
Maybe I still wouldn't be fast enough.
But you'll be able to strike without warning, with cohort weapons. I don't see that it should pose you any great difficulty, given the evident capabilities of your ship.
Baskin twirled his fingers around the stem of his goblet.
But then, that depends on how badly you want our Syrinx.
Merlin said.
Quite badly, if I'm going to be honest.
Would you do it?
Merlin looked at Teal before answering, but she seemed distracted, her gaze caught by one of the portraits. It was the picture of King Curtal, the ancestor Baskin had mentioned only a little while earlier. While the style of dress might not have changed, the portrait was yellowing with old varnish, its colours time-muted.
I'd need guarantees, he said, starting with proof that this Syrinx even exists.
That's easily arranged, Prince Baskin said.
Tyrant had a biometric lock on Merlin, and it would shadow the renouncer all the way to Havergal. If it detected that Merlin was injured or under duress, Tyrant would deploy its own proctors to storm the cruiser. But Merlin had gauged enough of his hosts to conclude that such an outcome was vanishingly unlikely. They needed his cooperation much too badly to do harm to their guest.
Locrian showed Merlin and Teal to their quarters, furnished in the same sumptuous tones as the stateroom.
When the door opened and Merlin saw that there was only one bed, albeit a large one, he turned to Teal with faked resignation.
"It's awkward for both of us, but if we want to keep them thinking you've been travelling with me for years and years, it'll help if we behave as a couple."
Teal waited until Locrian had shut the door on them and gone off on his own business. She walked to the bed, following the gently, dreamy-up curve of the floor.
"You're right," she said,
glancing back at Merlin before she sat on the edge of the bed.
"It will help.
And at least for now, I'd rather they didn't know I was on the Swallow Ship, so I'm keen to maintain the lie."
"Good. Very good.
But we share the bed, and nothing else. You're of no interest to me, Merlin. Maybe you're not a traitor or a fool, I'll give you that much. But you're still a fat, swaggering drunk who thinks far too much of himself." But Teal patted the bed.
"Still, you're right. The illusion's useful."
Merlin settled himself down on his side of the bed.
"No room for manoeuvre there? Not even a little bit?"
"None."
"Then we're clear. Actually, it's a bit of a relief. I meant to say,
if this is about what I just spoke about,
I just wanted to say, I understand how strange all this must be. Not everyone goes back to a place they were 1,300 years ago. In a way, it's a good job it was such a long time ago. At least we don't have to contend with any living survivors from those days, saying that they remember you being on the diplomatic team.
It was 43 generations ago. No one remembers."
Merlin moved to the window, watching the stars wheel slowly by outside. There was his own ship, a sharp sliver of darkness against the greater darkness of space. He thought of the loves he had seen ripped from by time and distance, and how the sting of those losses grew duller with each year, but was never entirely healed. It was an old lesson for him, one he had been forced to learn many times. For Teal, this might be her first real taste of the cruelty of deep time, realising how far downstream she had come, how little chance she stood of beating those currents back to better, kinder times.
"I'd remember," he said softly.
He could see her reflection in the window, tyrant sliding through her like a barb, but Teal neither acknowledged his words nor showed the least sign that they had meant anything to her. 5 days was indeed ample time to prepare Merlin for the recovery operation, but only because the intelligence was so sparse. The brigands were holed up on an asteroid called Mundar, an otherwise insignificant speck of dirt on some complex, whistling orbit that brought it into the territorial space of both Havergal and Gefurius. Their leader was a man called Struxer, but beyond one fuzzy picture, the biographical notes were sparse. Fortunately, there was more on the computer itself. The iron tactician was a spherical object about 4 metres across, quilted from pole to pole in thick military-grade armour. It looked like some hard-shelled animal rolled up into a defensive ball. Merlin saw no obvious complications. It needed no external power inputs and would easily fit within Tyrant's cargo hold. Getting hold of it was another matter. Baskin's military staff knew how big Mundar was and had estimates of its fortifications, but beyond that, things were sketchy. Merlin skimmed the diagrams and translated documents, but told Baskin that he wanted Teal to see the originals. He was still looking out for any gaps between the raw material and what was deemed fit for his eyes, any hint of a cover-up or obfuscation.
"Why are you so concerned?"
Teal asked him, halfway to Havergal, and they were alone in Baskin's stateroom, the documents spread out on the table.
Eating away at your conscience, is it? That you might be serving the wrong paymasters?
I'm not the one who chose sides, he said quietly.
You did, by selling the syrinx to one party instead of the other. Besides, the other lot won't be any better. Just a different bunch of stuffed shirts and titles, being told what to do by a different bunch of battle computers.
So, you've no qualms.
Qualms? Merlin set down the papers he had been leafing through. I've so many qualms, they're in danger of self-organising. I occasionally have a thought that isn't a qualm. But I'll tell you this, sometimes you just have to do the obvious thing. They have an item I need, and there's a favour I can do for them. It's that simple. Not everything in the universe is a riddle.
You'll be killing those brigands.
They'll have every chance to hand over the goods, and I'll exercise due restraint. I don't want to damage the tactician, not when it's the only thing standing between me and the syrinx.
What if you found out that Prince Baskin was a bloodthirsty warmonger?
Merlin, suddenly weary, settled his head onto his hand, propped up with an elbow.
Shall I tell you something? This war of theirs doesn't matter. I don't give a damn who wins or who loses, or how many lives end up being lost because of it. What matters, what my problem is the simple fact that the Huskers will wipe out every living trace of humanity if we allow them. That includes you, me, Prince Baskin, Strux's brigands, and every human being on either side of their little spat. And if a few people end up dying to make that Husker annihilation a little less likely, a few stupid mercenaries who should have known better than to play one side against the other, I'm afraid I'm not going to shed many tears.
You're cold.
No one loves life more than me, Teal. No one's lost more, either. You lost a ship, and that's bad. But I lost a whole world. And regardless of which side they're on, these people will all die if I don't act.
He returned to the papers, with their sketchy ideas about Mundar's reinforcements. But whatever focus he'd had was gone now.
They owe you nothing, Teal, and you owe them nothing in return. The fact that you were here all those years ago, it doesn't matter. Nothing came of it.
Teal was silent. He thought that was going to be the end of it, that his words had found their mark. But after a few moments, she said,
"Something isn't right. The man in the portrait, the one they call King Curtle, I knew him, but that wasn't his name."
As they made their approach to Havergal, slipping through cordon after cordon of patrols and defence stations, between armoured moons and belts of anti-ship mines, dodging patrol zones and battlefronts, Merlin felt a sickness building in him. He had seen worse things done to worlds in his travels, much worse in many cases. Seen worlds reduced to molten slag, or tumbling rubble piles, or clouds of hot, chemically complex dust. But, with few exceptions, those horrors had been perpetrated not by people, but by forces utterly beyond their control or comprehension. Not so here. The boiled oceans, the cratered landmasses, the dead and ashen forests, the poisoned, choking remnants of what had once been a life-giving atmosphere. These brutalities had been perpetrated by human action, people against people. It was an unnecessary and wanton crime, a cruel and injudicious act in a galaxy that already knew more than its share.
"Is Gefurius like this?" Merlin asked, as Renouncer cleaved its way to ground, Tyrant matching its course with an effortless insouciance.
Gaffurious? Baskin asked, a fan of wrinkles appearing at the corner of his eyes.
No, much, much worse. At least we still have a few surface settlements, a few areas where the atmosphere is still breathable.
I wouldn't count that as too much of a triumph.
Merlin's mind was flashing back to the last days of Lesethus, the tainted rubble of its shattered cities, the grey heave of its restless cold ocean, waiting to reclaim what humans had left to ruin. He remembered Minla taking him to the huge whetstone monument, the edifice upon which she had embossed the version of events she wished to be codified as historical truth, long after she and her government were dust.
"Don't judge us too harshly, Merlin," Baskin said. "We don't choose to be enmeshed in this war."
"Then end it."
"I intend to. But would you opt for any ceasefire with the Huskers, irrespective of the terms?"
He looked at Merlin, then at Teal, the three of them in Renouncer's sweeping command bridge, standing before its wide arc of windows, shuttered for the moment against the glare of re-entry.
"Of course you wouldn't. War is a terrible thing. But there are kinds of peace that are worse."
"I haven't seen much evidence of that," Merlin said.
"Oh, come now. Two men don't have to spend too much time in each other's company to know each other for what they are. We're not so different, Merlin. We disdain war, affect a revulsion for it. But deep down, it'll always be in our blood. Without it, we wouldn't know what to do with ourselves."
Teal spoke up. "When we first met, Prince Baskin, you mentioned that you hadn't always had this interest in languages. What was it you said? Toy soldiers and campaigns will only get you so far. That you used to play at war."
"In your language, in Maine," Baskin said, "the word for school is war crash. You learn war from the moment you can toddle.
But we don't play at it," Teal said. The two ships shook off their cocoons of plasma and bellied into the thicker airs near the surface. They levelled into horizontal flight, and the windows de-shuttered themselves, Merlin blinking against the sudden silvery brightness of day. They were overflying a ravaged landscape, pressed beneath a low, oppressive cloud ceiling. Merlin searched the rolling terrain for evidence of a single living thing, but all he saw was desolation. Here and there was the faint scratch of what might once have been a road, or the gridded thumbprint of some former town. But it was clear that no one now lived among these ruins. Ravines, deep and ominous, sliced their way through the abandoned roads. There were so many craters, their walls interlacing, that it was as if rain had begun to fall on some dull grey lake, creating a momentary pattern of interlinked ripples.
"If I need a planet looking after," Merlin mumbled, "remind me not to trust it to any of you lot."
"We'll rebuild," Baskin said, setting his hands on the rail that ran under the sweep of windows.
"Reclaim, cleanse, and resettle.
Even now, our genetic engineers are designing the hardy plant species that will re-blanket these lands in green and start making our atmosphere fit for human lungs."
He caught himself, offering a self-critical smile.
"You'll forgive me. Too easy to forget that I'm not making some morale-boosting speech at one of our armaments complexes."
"Where do you all live now?" Teal asked.
"There were surface cities here once, weren't there?"
"We abandoned the last of those cities, Lurga, when I was just out of boyhood," Baskin said.
Now we live in underground communities, impervious to nuclear assault. I bet the views are just splendid, Merlin said. Baskin met his sarcasm with a grim absence of humour. We endure, Merlin, as the cohort endures. Here, we're approaching the entry duct to one of the sub-cities. Do you see that sloping hole? He was nodding at an angled mouth, jutting from the ground like a python buried up to its eyes. The Gafurians are good at destruction, but less good at precision. They can impair our moons and asteroids, but their weapons haven't the accuracy to strike across space and find a target that small. We'll return a little later, and you'll be made very welcome. But first, I'd like to settle any doubts you might have about the Syrinx. We'll continue a little way north, into the Highlands. I promise it won't take long. Baskin was true to his word, and they had only flown for a few more minutes when the terrain began to buckle and wrinkle into the beginnings of a barren, treeless mountain range, rising in a series of forbidding steps, until even the high-flying spacecraft were forced to increase their altitude. Most of our military production takes place in these upland sectors, Baskin said. We have ready access to metallic ores, heavy isotopes, geothermal energy, and so on. Of course, it's well guarded. Missile and particle beams will be locking onto us routinely, both our ships. The only thing preventing either of them being shut down is our Imperial authorization. That, and the countermeasures on my ship, Merlin said, which could peel back these mountains like a scab if they detected a threat worth bothering with. But in truth, he felt vulnerable and was prepared to admit it, if only to himself. He could feel the nervous, bristling presence of all that unseen weaponry, like a migraine under the skin of Havergal. Soon, another mouth presented itself. It was wedged at the base of an almost sheer-sided valley. "Prepare for descent," Baskin said. "It'll be a tight squeeze, but your ship shouldn't have any difficulties following." They dived into the mouth and went deep, kilometres, and then tens of kilometres, before swerving sharply into a horizontal shaft. Merlin allowed not a flicker of reaction to betray his feelings, but the fact was that he was impressed in a grudging, disapproving way. There was expertise and determination here, qualities that the cohort's military engineers could well have appreciated. Anyone who could dig tunnels was handy in a war. A glowing orange light shone ahead. Merlin was just starting to puzzle over its origin when they burst into a huge underground chamber, a bubble in the crust of Havergal. The floor of the bubble was a sea of lava, spitting and churning, turbulent with the eddies and currents of some mighty underground flow, which just happened to pass in and out of this chamber. Suspended in the middle of the rocky void, underlit by flickering orange light, was a dark structure shaped like an inverted cone, braced in a ring and attached to the chamber's walls by three skeletal cantilevered arms. It was the size of a small palace or space station, and its flattened upper surface was easily spacious enough for both ships to set down on with room to spare. Bulkily suited figures, presumably protected against the heat and toxic airs of this place, came out and circled the ships. They attached a flexible docking connection to Renouncer. "We call it the facility," Baskin said, as he and his guests walked down the sloping throat of the docking connector. "Just that. No capital letters, nothing to suggest its ultimate importance. But for many centuries, this was the single most important element in our entire defence plan. It was here
that we hoped to learn how to make the syrinx work for us. He turned back to glance at Merlin and Teal. And where we failed, or continue to fail, I should say. But we had no intention of giving up, not while there was a chance. Teal and Merlin were led down into the suspended structure, into a windowless warren of corridors and laboratories. They went down level after level, past sealed doors and observation galleries. There was air and power and light, and clearly enough room for thousands of workers. But although the place was clean and well maintained, hardly anyone now seemed to be present. It was only when they got very deep that signs of activity began to appear. Here, the side rooms and offices showed evidence of recent use, and now and then uniformed staff members passed them, carrying notes and equipment. But Merlin detected no sign of haste or excitement in any of the personnel. The lowest chamber of the structure was a curious circular room. Around its perimeter were numerous desks and consoles, with seated staff at least giving the impression of being involved in some important business. They were all facing the middle of the room, whose floor was a single circular sheet of glass, stretched across the abyss of the underlying lava flow. The orange glow of that molten river underlit the faces of the staff, as if reminding them of the perilous location of their workplace. The glass floor only caught Merlin's eye for an instant, though. Of vastly more interest to him was the syrinx, suspended nose down in a delicate cradle over the middle of the glass. It was too far from the floor to be reached, even if someone had trusted the doubtful integrity of that glass panel. Merlin was just wondering how anyone got close to the syrinx when a flimsy connecting platform was swung out across the glass, allowing a woman to step over the abyss. Tiptoeing lightly, she adjusted something on the syrinx, moving some sort of transducer from one chalked spot to another, before folding the platform away and returning to her console. All was quiet, with only the faintest whisper of communications from one member of staff to another. In the event of an imminent malfunction, Baskin said, the syrinx may be dropped through the pre-weakened glass into the lava sea. That may or may not destroy it, of course. We don't know, but it would at least allow the workers some chance of fleeing the facility, which would not be the case if we used nuclear charges. I'm glad you've got their welfare at heart, Merlin said. Don't think too kindly of us, Baskin smiled back. This is war. If we thought there was a chance of the facility itself being overrun, then more than just the syrinx would need to be destroyed. Also, the equipment, the records, the collective expertise of the workers. You'd drop the entire structure, Teal said, nodding her horrified understanding. The reason it's fixed the way it is, on those three legs, you'd press a button and drop all these people into that fire. They understand the risks, Baskin said, and they're paid well, extremely well, I should say. Besides, it's a very good incentive to hasten the work of understanding. Merlin felt no kinship with these warring peoples, and little more than contempt for what they had done to themselves across all these centuries. But compared to the Waymakers, Merlin, Teal, and Baskin may as well have been children of the same fallen tribe, playing in the same vast and imponderable ruins. Not one of them wiser than the others. I'll need persuasion that it's real, he said. I never expected you to take my word for it, Baskin said. You may make whatever use of the equipment here you need, within limits, and you may question my staff freely. Easier if you just let me take it for a test ride. Yes, it would. For you.
Baskin reached out and settled a hand on Merlin's shoulder, as if they were two old comrades.
Shall we agree? A day to complete your inspection.
If that's all you'll allow.
I've nothing to hide, Merlin. Do you imagine I'd ever expect to dupe a man like you with a fake?
Go ahead and make your inquiries. My staff have already been told to offer you complete cooperation.
Baskin touched a hand to the side of his mouth, as if whispering a secret.
Truth to tell, it will suit many of them if you take the syrinx. Then they won't feel obliged to keep working in this place.
They were given a room in the facility, while Merlin made his studies of the syrinx. The staff were as helpful as Baskin had promised, and Merlin soon had all the equipment and records he could have hoped for. Short of connecting the syrinx to Tyrant's own diagnostic systems, he was able to run almost every test he could imagine, and the results and records quickly pointed to the same conclusion. The syrinx was the genuine article. But Merlin did not need a whole day to arrive at that conclusion. While Baskin kept Teal occupied with endless discussions in Maine, learning all that he could from this living speaker, Merlin used the console to dig into Havergal's history, and specifically, the background and career of Baskin's long-dead ancestor, King Kirtle. He barely needed to access the private records. What was in the public domain was clear enough. Kirtle had come to power within a decade of the Shrike's visit to this system. Merlin waited until they were alone in the evening, just before they were due to dine with Prince Baskin.
"You've been busy all day," Teal said. "I take it you've reached a verdict by now."
"The syrinx? Oh, that was no trouble at all. It's real, just as Baskin promised. But I used my time profitably, Teal. I found out something else as well, and I think you'll find it interesting. You were right about that portrait, you see.
I know you enjoy these games, Merlin, but if you want to get to the point...
The man who became King Kirtle began life called Tyrs. He watched her face for the flicker of a reaction that he knew she would not be able to conceal. The recognition of a name across years or centuries, depending on the reckoning. Merlin cleared his throat before continuing.
Tyrs was a high-ranking officer in the Havergal Military Command, assigned to the liaison group which dealt with the Shrike.
He'd have had close contact with your crew during the whole time you were in system. Her mouth moved a little before she found the words.
Tell me what happened to Tyrs.
Nothing bad. But what you might not have known about Tyrs was that he was also minor royalty. He probably played it down, trying to get ahead in his career on his own merits. And that was how things would have worked out if it wasn't for one of those craters. A Gafurian long-range strike, unexpected and deadly, taking out the entire core of the royal family. They were all killed, Teal, barely a decade after you left the system. But they had to maintain continuity, then more than ever. The chain of succession led to Tyrs, and he became King Kirtle. The man you knew ended up as king. She looked at him for a long moment, perhaps measuring for herself the reasons Merlin might have had to lie about such a thing, and then finding none that were plausible, beyond tormenting her for the sake of it.
Can you be sure?
The records are open. There was no cover-up about the succession itself. But the fact that Tyrs had a daughter... Merlin found that he had to glance away before continuing. That was difficult. The girl was illegitimate. And that was deeply problematic for the Havergal elite.
On the other hand, Tyrs was proud and protective of his daughter, and wouldn't accept the succession unless Cupis, that's the girl's name, was given all the rights and privileges of nobility. There was a constitutional tussle, as you can imagine, but eventually it was all settled in favour of Cupis, and she was granted legitimacy within the family. They're good at that sort of thing, royals. What you're saying is that Cupis was my daughter. For reasons that you can probably imagine, there's no mention that the child was born to a cohort mother. That would be a scandal beyond words. But, of course, you could hardly forget that you'd given birth to a girl, could you? She answered, after a moment's hesitation. We had a girl. Her name was Pauroke. Merlin nodded. A cohort name. Not much good for the daughter of a king. Tyrs would have had to accept a new name for the girl, something more suited to local customs. I don't doubt it was hard for him. If the old name was a link to the person he'd never see again, the person he presumably loved and missed. But he accepted the change in the girl's interests. Do you mind? Was there a reason you didn't stay with Tyrs, or Tyrs didn't join you on the shrike? Neither was allowed, Teal said, with a sudden coldness in her voice. What happened was difficult. Tyrs and I were never meant to get that close. And if one of us had stayed with the other, it would have made the whole affair a lot more public, risking the trade agreements. We were given no choice. They said if I didn't go along with things, the simplest option would be to make Pauroke disappear. So I had to leave my daughter behind on Havergal, and I was told it would be best for me if I forgot she ever existed, and I tried. But when I saw that portrait... I can't imagine what you went through, Merlin answered. But if I can offer anything by way of consolation, it's this. King Curtle was a good ruler, one of the best they had. And Queen Cupis did just as well. She took the throne late in her father's life, when Curtle abdicated due to failing health. And by all accounts, she was an honest and fair-minded ruler who did everything she could to broker peace with the enemy. It was only when the military computers overruled her plans. Merlin managed a kindly smile and produced the data tablet he'd been keeping by his side. It was of Havergal manufacture, but rugged and intuitive in its functions. He held it to Teal, and a woman's face appeared on the screen. That's Queen Cupis, he said. She wasn't one of the portraits we saw earlier, or you'd have made the connection for yourself. I can see you in her pretty clearly. Teal took the tablet and held it close to her, so that its glow underlit her features. Are there more images? She asked, with a catch in her voice, as if she almost feared the answer. Many, Merlin replied, and recordings, video and audio, taken at all stages in her life. I stored quite a few on the tablet. I thought you'd like to see them. Thank you, she said. I suppose. I know this is troubling for you, and I probably shouldn't have dug into Curtle's past, but once I'd started... And after Cupis? Nearly 1,200 years of history, Teal. Kings and queens and marriages and assassinations, all down the line. Too many portraits for one room. But your genes were in Cupis, and if I've read the family tree properly, they ought to be in every descendant, generation after generation. He paused, giving her time to take this all in. I'm not exactly sure what this makes you. Havergal royalty? By blood connection? I'm pretty certain they won't have run into this situation before. Equally certain, Baskin doesn't have a clue that you're one of his distant historical ancestors. And I suggest we keep it that way, at least for now.
Why?
Because it's information, Merlin said. And information's always powerful. He left her with the tablet. They were past the hour for their appointment with Prince Baskin now. But Merlin would go on alone and make excuses for Teal's lateness. Besides, he had something else on his mind.